Welcome to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by thesoberclub.com. I'm Genuinely Grace. This is for you if you've quit the booze or you'd like to, or maybe you're just sober curious. I'll bring you tips and motivation without any judgment, and there'll be inspiration from experts, quitlet authors, and sober heroes. Hi, welcome. This is Genuinely Grace. I hope you're well and whatever's happening for you in this current climate, I hope that you're coping well. I say that, but it's on my mind because I've had a couple of clients this week. I'm doing some coaching work and, you know, people are still struggling, and it may be that things are opening up around you and some people are going back to work, but you've got your little inner battles going on, or maybe not so little. And well, my top tip is reach out for the help that you need. Sometimes just having someone else to talk to, just to be inspired, just to help you catch sight of that better life, sometimes that's all that you need. Some of you may have seen that really well, sad is the only way I can put it, really, that documentary, The Horizon Programme, What's the Matter with Tony Slattery. We interviewed him, and I thought it was really quite heartbreaking to see that programme. I'm really impressed that he was willing to do it. Can't have been easy, literally bearing all like that. But it really shone a light on these different levels of mental illness and you know, who knows what's going on? But as someone said that I was talking to about it afterwards, someone who is in the medical profession said, you know, those kinds of psychiatric issues can't, it's really difficult to diagnose and begin to treat when everything's blurred by alcohol. And I've said it many times before, the link between alcohol and mental health issues is just, it can't be denied. And I always caveat that by saying, of course, I'm not saying ditch the booze and then every single thing linked to mental health will right itself. But there is a massive correlation, and so many people have found that their anxiety levels have reduced so dramatically. Just that incredible feeling when you're no longer numbing out all the time. And I had one client who has just had the most amazing experience, come off her HRT, come off antidepressants, is just totally rocking it, and the only thing that's changed is ditching the booze. And again, you know, caveat that, I'm not telling you to do that. I'm just sharing with you that amazing magic happens in all kinds of ways when people make this decision. I did a few radio interviews this week as well. And it's interesting because radio presenters, you know, almost always ask the same questions along the lines of, you know, well, were you an alcoholic? You know, how much were you drinking? And of course, I'm very happy to answer those questions. Answer, no, I wasn't an alcoholic. I wasn't at rock bottom. I wasn't dependent. It was perfectly safe for me to choose to stop drinking. And with the how much was I drinking question, well, I can tell you if you want, but it doesn't really make a difference. I guess I must have been probably getting close to a bottle of wine, probably certainly half a bottle. And then, of course, if it was a nice sunny day, you have one at lunchtime, don't you? So it would be creeping up to a bottle of wine. But then the people listening might think to themselves, oh, thank God for that. She's much worse than I am. That's good then, because I'm only on half a bottle, or, you know, or I only drink at weekends. But perhaps you drink to blackout at weekends. Who knows? The question isn't how much are you drinking? It's, are you drinking more than you want to? And have you just got this kind of inkling somewhere that your life would be better physically and emotionally without the booze? And if so, well, never been a better time. Heard me say that a lot lately. There has never been a better time than right now to ditch the booze. Somebody in the Sober Club was saying that they've been sober curious for a long time. They've been listening to podcasts. They've been, you know, following all the stuff that I do, and they know it's time, and they've made their decision. I'm going to start on the whatever it is, 8th of June. It's like, well, why? Why on earth would you wait? Why have another 10, 14 days to poison yourself? Just do it now. Do it now. You won't regret it. I don't think I've ever met anyone. I've never met anyone, have you? Has anyone ever met anyone who regrets ditching the booze? I don't think so. We've got some great guests for you today. Excellent new book, really excellent new book has come out. I mean, I love my Quitlet. I've told you so many times that it was the thing in the early weeks, the early months. I could not have got through without amazing quitting literature. Of the both kinds, I've often said this as well. The logical stuff I loved, you know, the William Porter, Alcohol Explained, and Jason Vale, Kick the Drink Easily, and Annie Grace, This Naked Mind, and Alan Carr's Easy Way to Stop Drinking. But I also love the inspirational stuff, the unexpected joy of being sober, and the Sober Diaries, and Mrs. Deer's Going Without, and so many more. You know, I've kind of read them all. So I was delighted. Yet another one is out. And this is a couple of great American gals, Jardine Lebert and Amanda Eyre Ward. And their publicity blurb says they wanted to live spontaneous and luxurious lives to escape the ordinary and enjoy the intoxicating. Their drinking, however, had started to numb them to the present moment instead of unlocking it. Ward was introduced to Lebert when she first got sober, and as they became friends, the two women talked about how they yearned to create lives that were technicolor, beautifully raw, connected, blissed out and outside the lines. But how? The Sober Lush. So this is a great book. I think it's going to do tremendously well. It's with a mainstream publisher. It's out in a couple of days in the UK. So I really hope you enjoy this interview with Amanda and Jardine.
And it's just so great to be able to chat to you on the podcast. And obviously we're all in different places, so no doubt we'll all cross-talk over each other, but never mind. who wants to introduce them first? Shall we start with you, Jardine? Tell us a little bit about you.
Sure. I'm from New York originally, and then I drifted west, lived a decade in Austin, which is where Amanda and I got to know each other. And then I've been in Los Angeles for the past couple of years. Have always pursued writing since I was a kid. I've always loved it. But I also did a ton of odd jobs to support myself and worked in bars for probably about 10 years. I was always, from the age of 18 on, a heavy drinker and social drinker, party drinker. And probably in my early 20s knew I should slow down. And it was a long road to doing that. And I finally did for this run on January 8th, 2013. And then met Amanda a few years later.
Wow. Yeah. So you've been sober a while then.
Yeah, a little while. It's starting to feel like something substantial. You know, it's always touch and go in the beginning. And now it's every day I can rely on it more and more.
Feels solid. What about you, Amanda? Tell us a bit about your work and your background.
I also grew up in New York, in the suburbs, though. And my dad was an alcoholic. So when I was about 14, I decided to defy everyone and start drinking. Somehow I thought that was breaking the pattern and showing it to the man. So I've lived all over the world. I've studied writing and worked a million jobs. And drinking was my constant companion until a little over 4 years ago. I was a blackout drinker, and it's just the greatest thing in the world. I was just telling my kids yesterday about the intro to The Sober Lush, where I write about that journey. And it's so nice to be able to end the story by saying, and that's never going to happen again. And yes, I've published my first novel when I was 30, Sleep Toward Heaven, which is about women on death row in Texas. And I've gone on to write every morning. It's the thing that saves me, being alone and writing. And had my first New York Times bestseller 3 weeks ago. So
Wow. It's
a long road. And I feel I really was going for a walk with my little dog and thinking, well, they tell you to wait for the miracle. And here it is. So it's been a great few months. Well,
yeah.
Awful few months.
So obviously, both being writers, was it always kind of a given that you would write this book together, you would write The Sober Lush, or was it that you'd kind of thought of your sobriety as completely separate from your writing work? I don't know who wants to answer that.
I can answer that. Yeah. You know, I think Jardine and I both had been asked to write our stories. You know, Quitlet is a thing, and I think our agents and friends were interested in our stories. Everyone always is, you know, when you say you're not cooking, the first thing they want to know is how low did you go? And I personally, writing in the first person, writing about myself, just never felt right. I wrote the chapter that's called Amanda's Story, The Jade Earrings, at the beginning of this book. And then I never wrote anything else about my sobriety. It still does feel a bit private to me. I haven't really been very out about it, except amongst my close friends. And I'm working through some of that now, because obviously I'm proud of my sobriety, but I think I still have some of that childhood shame tied in. But anyway, so then when Jardine and I started writing it in the wee voice, it just took off. And even now I feel so lucky to be coming out with this story with Jardine by my side. I don't think I could have done it myself.
What about you, Jardine? Because you've been sober even longer. And I mean, it's interesting because in more recent years, you know, I mean, I've been sort of nearly two and a half for me. And so I think it's certainly we've all seen that in the last few years, the popularity of sobriety has grown. And although there are still some sober shamers out there, it's getting less because more cool, hip people are doing it, right? So when you kicked in, you probably did go through a thing of, I'm not going to tell anyone.
Oh my God. I mean, when I think back, it's interesting to finally be of an age where you can really see massive changes in culture. You know, when you're 22, you can't really look back on the past 4 years of your adulthood. And at this point, I can. And yeah, it's changed radically because I knew in my late 20s, I had like a gut feeling like you will have a better life if you can get sober. And it obviously took me a while to do that. And I think part of what kept me from it was I used the fact that there weren't a lot of people and a lot of books and a lot of discussions in the mainstream. And I was very furtive, very private about even looking things up. You know, I remember getting my one book that I could find. It was Pete Hamill's book on
how your copy.
What's that?
I have your copy of A Drinking Life. You gave it to me.
You know, in the beginning, it was really just, there were like two books about drinking. And I love what has happened. I love that it's not an embarrassing conversation all the time. And it is. You still run into situations where it's really awkward to talk about and people don't have the language and they're worried or embarrassed for you. But it reminds me in a different way. Amanda and I have talked about this, about when we were young and vegetarians would come to a dinner and everyone was sort of like,
oh God, what do I cook? Yeah. Will they eat chicken? Yeah.
Just at all. Right?
And now it's like the idea of being a vegetarian intersects with the idea of like farm food and forage food and all these beautiful wild foods and freshness. And, you know, sobriety used to just be a medical problem, a therapy problem. And now it's more about mindset and lifestyle, and it can be something beautiful and bountiful instead of like, you know.
Totally. Yeah. It can be a choice, our choice, can't it? It's great. So I'm quite interested in the fact that, you know, being from the States, and as you'll be well aware, the culture is slightly different when it comes to drinking, or it certainly was. I mean, you know, us Brits are the kind of the boozers. And in the States, unless I've got this wrong, my perception is that a lot of people in the States are certainly up until fairly recently were a lot happier to use the word alcoholic. It doesn't have a stigma necessarily in the States that it has here. Am I right about that?
I mean, I think one thing that I've found amazing about how people are talking about alcohol in the US, at least, is that I used to think I had to hit my bottom before I stopped. I had to. So the question for me was always, do I have to stop now? Am I completely done? And I hear people now saying, maybe I'd be happier if I just stopped, or if I didn't drink tonight, or if I didn't drink for a few months. That was never a possibility for me and my circle. And I actually traveled a lot and so ended up hanging out with a lot of British friends. Maybe that was why. They're also so many of my close friends. But I think, at least amongst my circles, being an alcoholic is still considered embarrassing. You know?
Okay.
You can't hold your liquor. You can't just be careful. So for me, it was a tremendous freedom to say, yeah, I've got there. I'm done.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, one of the things I said in my TEDx talk is, you know, not to ask yourself, are you drinking too much, but to ask yourself, would my life be better, you know, physically and emotionally without alcohol? So for you, Jardine, then, all those years back, how did you get through those early weeks? Was it difficult for you? Did you have any support?
You know, I tried a few kind of 30-day runs starting in my late 20s. And so 20 years ago, I started doing it privately, secretly, telling a couple people. And it was easier to tell people it's a 30-day run or something. And I was always insanely, dramatically happier. And I always would give up after 30 days because I started to feel like I was missing out. And I didn't ever graduate to any other new friends or connections. So I would stay with my group, stay with my patterns, but just take out alcohol. And then this run, I had a great therapist and she introduced me to an outpatient program that was run by this incredible guy that was well known in the community, just really generous, open guy. So he ran a great outpatient program and that changed everything to be in a room with human beings. For some reason, I was very intimidated by 12-step and the outpatient was strangely easier. So to begin with a room full of people instead of private, secret, you know, looking for books in the library, there's just something about that simple asking for help and getting help and then giving help to someone else. The stuff that happens when you're in a room with other people sometimes is
that connection is really everything, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Okay. What about you, Amanda? How did you cope in those early weeks and months?
I was really lonely and I had tried to quit before as well and had gone to meetings. I think I chose the meetings where I wouldn't find anyone like myself on the surface. So I would go to kind of meetings in rough parts of town and I would think, I am a mom, you know, I have a lot going on. I'm a writer. I don't have anything in common with these people. And I would try to tell myself that, and then someone would stand up and say exactly what was going on in my brain. And so I was in this place where I think I was trying to convince. Then for a while, I thought, oh, now I know all the tools of the 12 steps. So I'm going to go back and drink with those tools somehow. I don't know. And then I think I was probably in a stint that would have ended if I had not met Jardine. We have a friend in common, an editor in town, Kathy Blackwell, and she introduced us. And it was a whole new idea for me because Jardine had already built a sober life, you know, a beautiful life where alcohol was beside the point. And so, and this is a lot about what we write about in the Sober Lush. So I had to really learn how to break down my life. It felt like setting off fireworks and just blowing the whole thing down because I couldn't go to the same parties. I couldn't hang around with the same people. I was terrified of that. And finally I had someone else who got it. Just Jardine, you know, and then I found my way back to groups of people who I actually am very active in Al-Anon, given my upbringing, that's where I found my place. And it's just been, it was a game changer. And so I think that's the reason we wanted to write the Sober Lush, to say, hey, join us. There is this group of people who are building a life from the ground up, built on pleasure and beauty and being kind to yourself and having, and being wild and, you know, listening to your heart. And so when we started writing it, you know, we're writing in the wee voice as if there's this huge, massive, amazing group of us. And it's really just us. My hope is that it will bring to people what I found when I met Jardine, which was I can do it this way.
Yeah, I think it's just amazing, isn't it? Just to have some inspiration and have, you know, someone who's a little bit ahead of us, it makes all the difference. So Jardine, tell us about the title then.
Well, you know, and I think it has a different, slightly different meaning in the UK from the US. Mm.
Tell me what you're thinking.
You know, it has some, a little bit of a, an illicit dimension to it, where it's about the lush is the one who stays at the bar too long, goes mm-hmm. to the bar. But then lush life is really about glamour and plenty and sensuality and sensory pleasure and, mm. and hedonism, not in its kind of, you know, bloodthirsty, selfish kind of definition, but hedonism just in that you are in the moment and you're enjoying all the senses. Mm. So it felt like something to sort of reclaim on that front, because I basically just said all the things that I thought were entwined with alcohol and drugs, and you could not have them unless you were actively drinking. The idea of putting together a lush life with sobriety felt sort of challenging in a good way.
Absolutely, yeah. Tell us about some of the benefits then, just you know, some of the things that you share in the book, just to inspire people who are thinking, wow, these women sound cool, I want to be like that. Tell us about some of the changes that came about for you both.
I mean, I think it's funny, we set out to write the book and we first wrote it as a year, almost like a calendar of things to do. So we just investigated, like, what were the things that we, when we gave up drinking, missed? You know, we started with like New Year's. Mm. New Year's for me used to be like a mega blowout, insane party every year. So I would sleep for 3 days after, I'd wake up like Phoenix from the ashes, brand new. And even though it was from damage, it was a feeling of being like this freshly hatched little chick or something, you know? So for the very first entry, we thought, what are those feelings that we're missing? And it wasn't the feeling of being hungover. It was the feeling of having kind of made some sort of exciting transgression, or like broken up a pattern and started the new year with like a profound kind of heightened experience. So I've done the polar bear dive on New Year's Day, and that was one of the first things I did as a sober person. And it was so fun to reverse New Year's and to do something that still was exciting, was still bonding. I went with a bunch of people and still felt like it marked that day as special. So the whole book kind of goes through seasonal things. It didn't end up doing it within a calendar year, but it really looks at your day-to-day life and all the different ways you can either find transgression, find delivery from the ordinary, find culinary pleasure, find love and connection. But not in great abstract ways, more in these kind of little tiny ways.
I mean, I think that's so important. You know, you're right, because it is those little things that keep us stuck for so long. You know, for me as a sort of busy mum, when I moved house, that was kind of the catalyst for my drinking to ramp up. And there's a sort of deli around the corner, and that was my me time, you know, and that was that, it was just so ingrained, that sort of, I must have my treat. So, and you know, that needed to be reframed, because otherwise the little unconscious mind would be, you know, I'd be feeling really sorry for myself, you know, if I hadn't been able to create something else. And I think that's what keeps people stuck. What about for you, Amanda? What were the kind of, what benefits did you really notice, or what changes came about for you?
Well, you put it so beautifully. I mean, I also, I write, there's a chapter in the book called The Arsenic Hour. And my relatives in Savannah, Georgia used to call the end of a day with children the arsenic hour. And they had a very strong cocktail that would get you through the arsenic hour, because you just needed to numb out because it was awful. And I, you know, without an arsenic hour cocktail in my hand, all of a sudden, you know, those hours that were hard for me became worse, and everything became louder, and it became more impossible. And so what I had to learn, in the same way as you said, is how to, I mean, Jardine and I have been writing about some essays to promote the book, about how you have to kind of become a detective and analyze, you know, what was I looking for with that cocktail? What did I want? And what I wanted in many cases was to get the hell out of my house. Yeah. And I can't, you know, so when you're taking care of children, you can't just leave. But I have a backyard, and I could just say, my husband travels a lot, or he used to before quarantine. I can say, here's the cereal, I'm going to lie in the hammock. for an hour. And it felt impossible to do that. And I felt terribly guilty, but I realized that's what it took for me to stay. So I write going out and lying there, my daughter kind of looking at me outside. And I said, you know, she'll get to see, this is what it's like for a mother to choose herself.
Yeah, that's absolutely.
It was a lot of those moments for me.
Yeah. I mean, so many of us are so bad at the self-care piece. This is what I'm trying to do, you know, with the Sober Club, is trying to remind people constantly about the importance of this self-care, because I'm constantly staggered, actually, at how bad so many of us are. I mean, me included, but I'm getting better at it. But I've spoken to people who they're busy all the time. You know, they're busy women and they're cooking, they're baking, and they're gardening, and they're doing this for this person, and they're literally never, ever, ever stop. And then you ask them, okay, so what do you do for you? You know, what do you do that really lights you up? And they're nothing at all, literally nothing, not one thing that they do. Because if they start to think of doing something for themselves, however small, then they get this feeling of guilt. What is that about?
Right as you're saying, I was thinking yesterday I had 2 hours where my 8-year-old was taken care of, and I did not even know what to do. Couldn't even think of it. So it was hot, so I wouldn't have a hot bath. So I watched that show, Hightown. I watched a very child inappropriate television show, and it was actually really fun. But it is hard. And the guilt does come with it. And the guilt is some of what I was trying to drink away. And then I would feel more guilty.
Yeah, totally.
You know? And the Sober Lush about trying to examine what I needed, you know, and listening to that. I had just been silencing that voice with Chardonnay for 20 years.
Yeah, yeah. So Jardine, what would you recommend that people starting out on this? What give me a couple of top tips that you would suggest that people try and put in place or try and think about?
I mean, I think, you know, we definitely wrote this book as a sort of complement to all the different things like the Sober Club, like books by Annie Grace, you know. So it's, this book is definitely not about how to get sober, stay sober necessarily, because I think that is always just a really unique path. But what I can speak to is opening one's mind to the idea that sobriety can be technicolor and can be beautiful. I've really prospered in the past few years, well, from our conversation together, Amanda's and my conversation together, examining all this stuff and seeing what can be beautiful, what can not just take the place, but take its own place in our lives. And then also from looking around to see what people I know are doing. Like, I have a friend, once I got sober, I started like paying more attention to what people did besides drinking drugs. I thought I only knew how to do that and only knew people who did that. It's amazing. I have a friend who just joined a women's motorcycle club and go on camping trips every weekend. And another friend who has a beehive and invited me over to taste honey. And there's so many people around doing so many beautiful things that can take the space up.
I think you're so right. Your world sort of expands, doesn't it, when you finally ditch the booze. I think when I look back, I think everything was so contained. And you're so right. What a lovely thing. And yet if someone invited me to go and look at bees, I probably would have thought, oh, no, I'm too busy drinking. So you're right. It frees up that time. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's funny though. You have a little moment when you quit, and then you have tons of weird time. You know?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, when you think, what the hell? Who knew that there were two 6 o'clocks in one day?
Yeah, I love that quote where it's, you know, you have to lose sight of one shore to be able to eventually reach the other. And there's this moment in early sobriety where you're floating in the middle and you just don't know where you're headed. And my advice probably would be to just stay strong and keep looking.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So what do you want people to get from this book then, guys? Do you want to tell us first, Amanda?
Yes, I think that when I tried to get sober so many times, it felt as if I needed to resign myself to a life of deprivation, of a sort of gray but safe life. And what I want people to take from this book is that, I mean, it's incredibly hard to get sober. Let's be honest. We all know. The first months are really hell. But when you do the work, when you listen to yourself, when you go through the anger and the boredom, there is a beautiful, sweet life on the other side. And we're there now. And I'm so lucky to enjoy it. And I want to tell myself, you know, the 10 years I should have quit and didn't. Just give it up. There's so much left.
There's
exactly. So much on the other side.
Yeah, love that. Anything you want to add, Jardine?
I think that's it. From gray and safe was the fear, and lush and beautiful, and difficult sometimes too, but lush and beautiful also on the other side.
Excellent. Well, I wish you guys so much success with the book. I think it's going to be massive, and I look forward to seeing you do more stuff, and also all your other amazing, exciting work. Just briefly remind us what you've both got happening right now in with your other projects.
My novel, The Jet, has been out about a month and 2 months, and you can find out more about me at amandaward.com and all over the place that I'm supposed to be posting.
Excellent. So the Jet Setters is the one that was Reese Witherspoon's book club pick a while back. That's amazing.
Yes.
Wow, how cool. Amazing. And Jardine, tell us what you've got going on right now.
The last novel I put out was called White Fur, which is in the UK. But that was a couple of years ago. And then I just had a film I co-wrote released with the director Drake Doremus, and Shailene Woodley stars as a woman who just gave up drinking. So.
What's that called? That's Endings Beginning.
And it's,
excellent.
It's available everywhere online now. So
great. So when lockdown ends and people can travel again, maybe you guys are going to come to London. If so, we'll have to do something together.
That would be so fun.
I would love that so much, because whenever I came, I would go to the Soho Club and get too drunk. So I'd love to try something new.
Yeah, that would be brilliant. Let's do something. We'll put it in the diary when things open up. Thank you so much, guys. The book is The Sober Lush. Amanda and Jardine, thank you so much for taking the time to chat to me today.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
So the book is The Sober Lush, and as I've already said, you can check out that one and a whole host of amazing Quitlet. If you're new to all of this, trust me, this is going to be the thing that is going to help you so much to really feel connected to the choice that you've made. Maybe you're onto a different behaviour change now. Maybe you're quitting sugar or ditching drugs or cigarettes, whatever it might be. So make sure you get some connection and some inspiration there as well. Obviously, we got all that stuff going down in the Sober Club. And think about, focus on your health and well-being. I can't say this enough. I'm steeped in it because I'm kind of doing this work all the while, and I run my Imperfectly Natural website, and I have a Facebook group, Imperfectly Natural Self-Care. If you want to join that, there's a free Facebook group. Feel free to come on there and have a look at some of the recommendations. So I'm kind of talking about natural health and well-being all the time. But if you're new to this, if maybe you're just dipping the toes in the water, again, you know, lockdown or when things are not quite normal, it's a good time to try this stuff out, to try not washing your hair quite as often. Bet you thought you'd never hear me say that in a podcast. I know we've all gone feral during lockdown. Well, I have. But, you know, we all do wash our hair too often. And actually, we really need to let the natural oils come back and try using skincare without chemicals and some of these things that I bang on about. And of course, boosting your immunity. And I don't care what anybody says. Yes, wash your hands. Yes, stay at home or stay alert. But also boost your immunity. It's really important. I couldn't believe it last week. I saw a bit in the press. It was one of those myth busters. I wish I had it in front of me to read to you because I was literally incredulous. It was in one of the mainstream papers, and they were busting myths about COVID-19 because, of course, there's lots of stuff on the internet that one might think is a myth. And this little particular little section was busting the myth that foods can help. And it actually said, I kid you not, obviously, I'm paraphrasing, but it said something along the lines of there have been people who have suggested on the internet that certain foods can help against COVID-19, foods that might help boost immunity, such as garlic, ginger, broccoli, celery, whatever, listed a bunch of others, cabbage, that people claim can boost immunity. However, this is absolutely not proven and has not been tested. I mean, really? Really? It actually said that. So that stuff's going to do you harm, right? I mean, I would argue absolutely the opposite is true. Absolutely that stuff's been tested. Of course, ginger, garlic, broccoli, cabbage, you know, all these amazing dark green leafy vegetables and anti-inflammatories like ginger and garlic absolutely have been tested for thousands of years. And yes, they do boost our immunity. And no, they're not going to do us any harm unless we happen to be allergic, which is highly unlikely. So there you go. You know, we have to kind of think for ourselves, don't we? It's hugely important. And make your own decisions before lockdown ends properly, before you get properly back to, in inverted commas, normal. Make your choice. Don't end up just going with, you know, everyone who's getting back out there and when pubs reopen and getting drunk. Why would you want to do that? You know, value yourself more than that and reach out for help if you'd like any. I've got loads of great guests coming up. I'm so lucky to be able to interview some great people. And as always, if you have a suggestion for me, I'd love to hear it. And make sure you check out the Sober Club. Of course, I've still got my little free mini ebook PDF called How to Get and Stay Sober During Lockdown. Obviously, the tips apply to any time. But if you are going to, you know, if you're determined to use these last few weeks or however long it is to nail this, then absolutely go for it. I really hope it helps. Reach out for the help you need. You can always email me, janie@janieleegrace.com. You can find me on Instagram @janieleegrace and on Facebook. And obviously, the blog posts and competitions are there at thesoberclub.com. We do have some competitions to win some alcohol-free drinks. If you want to try some out, then have a go at entering some of the competitions. We have some Sea Arch to win, some Sippling beverages. We've got a competition to win binary drinks. And, oh, another one that's completely slipped my mind right now, but I'll remember. Anyways, you'll find them all there. So go to thesoberclub.com, check out the blog posts and the competitions, and obviously have a look at the membership. And have a good week. Stay on track. And if you're doing this really hard thing, then give yourself a really big hug. Thank you for listening to the Alcohol Free Life podcast brought to you by The Sober Club. Please rate and review. And if you want support, accountability and inspiration, and you want to live your best life without the booze, check out thesoberclub.com.